catechesis in the parish school. I've been asked for you, and I intended to have a little more space to write on, but I've taken most of it myself. I used, on purpose, a basic lesson plan template in the baseline lesson plan in classes. You think in terms of pre-grammar, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and that is introducing material or making a connection with the student, and what is going to, what needs to be learned today or in this lesson. Logic, getting the student more familiar with it, integrating it with other things that you hope are in their heads. And then rhetoric, being able to use it. And since this was about school, I thought I'd lay out some notes for you in that order. But that's what pre-grammar, grammar, logic, and rhetoric are for on your notes. Pre-grammar, preparation, holding the pencil. You might think of grammar then, putting the dots on the paper. Logic is connecting these dots. And then rhetoric is doing art, making art, and drawing figures, understanding. Sometimes it's divided up into knowledge, and then understanding, being able to do things with knowledge, and then wisdom, being wise about how to use your understanding in the world. But as we'll see, catechesis is not simply the classroom instruction of catechism. And I missed the first few days of the conference, but I've heard enough today that I think that's been taught pretty clearly to you already, that and the catechumenate is not simply a catechism that you put in somebody's hands. You're getting used to these different words and how to use them. The assignment today, or to this workshop, is to talk about catechesis in the parish school. Now, that's not going to mean, okay, how do we use the Heidelberg or the Prayer Book Catechism? How do we use that in the life of a school? It may involve that, but that isn't the purpose of this workshop. It's understanding the whole parish school really as catechesis. And it is always teaching. I delved into my good paper in print and color. Because that's part of catechesis, isn't it? I don't know whether to keep the paper or not. A little, since you got the good paper instead of a photocopy of your paper, it's supposed to tell you, oh, this is just a little bit more important. And I'm not very good at all of that. People in publication, they have exactly in view what they want for the kind of paper, how glossy it's supposed to be, how heavy it's supposed to be, and how it's supposed to fit exactly the kind of marketing that they're doing, but that they're thinking about that, I want you to understand that as catechesis. That's all part of the teaching process. So catechesis is not simply going through catechism. Can you describe a graduate by what school she attended? If you're from Dallas, you might hear a phrase. Well, she's a Huckabee girl. In fact, the lady who bequeathed the funds for us to begin our prayer school was a Huckabee girl. And there were a band of about six girls from decades ago, who are now in the 60s, I think. They all came together for her funeral. But they were her girls. What is a Huckabee girl? Or St. Mark's boy? What is a DTS grad like? They're not all the same. What's a Harvard graduate like? Is a school so powerful that it can shape the kind of person that graduates from it? Apparently so, or we wouldn't even, this kind of language and these questions wouldn't make sense to you. Granted, there's a lot of differences from person to person. But evidently, a school does have that kind of power. That we can say, for a business or a law firm, and say, I want graduates from that school. In Galatians, St. Paul describes the law as a tutor or schoolmaster which led Israel to Christ. Schools can do that kind of thing. Can a school really have that much power? Well, apparently so. Paul also uses it as a paradigm. What are some other ways that we speak of education as catechesis? Somebody goes through a rough time and they say, well, he's graduating from the school of
hard knocks.
Expensive tuition in the
thousands.
School of
life.
That one wasn't quite this. But how powerful is a school to shape a child? Who that you know of can discuss the faith, and not just as the moralistic therapeutic deism that you've heard about? Are there schools that produce graduates that can discuss the faith, and not just as moralistic therapeutic deism? Well, faith also has a grammar, a logic, and a rhetoric. And in education, everybody loves to focus on rhetoric and logic to pursue a moral, thinking, and skilled high school graduate. And I contend that without the grammar of faith, logic and rhetoric are of limited ability. Thank you. And we need to have the grammar of faith. You need to have dots to be that can be connected. You can't just jump in and be able to persuade beautifully without knowing the material. And a catechism is one of the basic tools to teach that grammar, but there is much more. Catechesis is much more. Now, the concept of catechism, I'm sure you've learned by now, is composed of three things.
Creeds, Lord's Prayer,
and commandments. Those are the traditional three pillars. They're called catechisms. What else was added in the offices of instruction? Is there something not covered?
Knowledge description.
In the second office of instruction.
Oh.
The sacraments.
Sacraments and. Church government. Sacraments and church government were added in the second office of instruction, but they're not in the primary catechism. So it seems that the question we're asked to consider during this workshop is, what is catechesis and how does the parish help or hinder this process? And one of the things I would like to argue a bit for you today, and then have some discussion that flows out of that, especially as we get to the rhetoric part, to give you some content, some data, connect a few things for you, but then I'd like to have some discussion in the rhetoric portion of this and ask you some questions and have you ask some questions. I'd like to argue that every school has tremendous catechetical power. In fact, I might even want to argue that a school has unconquerable catechetical power. That it is so powerful that home and church cannot overwhelm it. And I don't know that I would want to make a watertight argument going that far, but I've seen enough catastrophes that I wonder. Catastrophes from many people who never wanted to go that way and did everything in their power to stop it. So we are going to talk about catechesis in the parish school, but I want to do that within that broader argument. I think school has such power. Every school is catechetical, and it's going to teach all the basic belief structures that its graduates will come away with. Now, that's not an exception, I realize, but I think as a general rule, I'd probably take that as a thesis and go with it. The school is catechesis. It teaches in the way it feels and moves and breathes. It's not just curriculum. In fact, curriculum is secondary. One of Father Bannock's favorite things that always made an impression on me was asking parents, is the difference between a Christian school and a non-Christian school just that we have a different curriculum on creation, or Bible class? Isn't it far more telling, or that the subversive ability of a school is that you can graduate someone at 18 years old and say, you have learned everything you need to know. And it's never mentioned God. So you can learn everything you need to know. What's the subtext of that? That has been carefully taught as catechesis for 12 years. It's that God is irrelevant to truth. Probably was never said once. What? But that is being carefully taught catechetically in the catechesis of a school for 12 years. God is irrelevant to truth. Now that is antithetical to saying that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. So it won't do for a parish school or any Christian school to say, well, we're a Christian school because we always say that fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. It helps, that's a good thing to say, and should be said frequently, and it should be in print frequently. But that doesn't mean that that is the catechesis of your school. You need a whole lot more than that sentence. So the way that a school moves and feels and breathes, I didn't bring some of the other things I wanted to bring from our own school. I'm going to show you a schedule. The schedule means that more or less you start geometry at this time and you end at another time. And recess begins now, and then Mr. Melton's finished teaching you all. That's it. And it's time to go back to history. It means that knowledge is going to be governed by some kind of order. It means that the best way to learn, and there are those who would argue and say this is not the best way to learn, but having a schedule tells a child, you're not going to learn in life just by doing what you want for how long you want. And there are those who would argue that that other way is the better way to learn. I'm not going to get into that. But I'm just saying, even having a schedule is part of your catechesis. It is saying that you're going to follow this order, and we're going to teach you these things from here to now. Sorry, now we're finished. I know we'd like to develop this a little further today, but it is the end of this hour. For better or for worse, that is catechesis. In the life of a school, I've seen some that build everything up. All tests are given on Friday. And you work up toward Friday. And then you wear your best clothes. You know, you don't have casual day on Friday. You have not just regular uniform day, you have best uniform day. And I've seen schools that have operated that way. All the teaching throughout the week is toward Friday. And Friday is almost all testing. In your best clothes, and you bring your best lunch. And it's something to celebrate, because there is the liturgical achievement of the week in your school. a calendar teaches about time. Taking Easter Monday off. Usually students weren't going to argue, sometimes parents did, because it was a bit annoying if they had work and now their kids didn't have school. But the days that you go to school, the marking of your terms. They begin on such a date and they end on such a date. The days that you do go to school, the days that you don't, the time that you take off. Do you simply follow, is it only spring break now because this is when the ISD does? And there's wisdom in that because people have kids in other schools maybe. But when a school makes its decision of what days to take off, that's teaching about time, isn't it? And calendars. That, well, the school is not some independent life from the church. The school is going to live within the life of the church and the Christian calendar. Even if just some of those days are. One of the things we do in our school is we start every day with morning prayer and end with evensong. But on the days that are feast days, we have Holy Communion. And systematically, that's teaching a child that there's something different on March 25th, and we may not have anything else, maybe we will after this afternoon. But that you have communion on the feast days, and that teaches the students. And maybe you have an unbaptized student, but at least they get a blessing. But they are learning that the school lives around the life of Christ and the church calendar. That's catechesis. Dress and behavior codes. We were at an education conference in Louisville last week, and one of the headmasters at our school said he comes from a school that first had no uniform code whatsoever. Then they had uniform code, but they would have no uniform days. And teachers started comparing notes, and academic work was measurably lower any time there was no uniform day. There's a connection between these things. That's part of catechesis. It doesn't mean one is right and the other is wrong, but it does mean this is probably a wisdom issue. Probably one is better than the other. But this is all part of catechesis. How its faculty and students are addressed. It can feel a little bit strange sometimes to faculty when you've just known someone as Mark all of your life, and now you move to Tyler, and during school hours at least, he's Mr. White. But faculty get used to addressing one another. It doesn't take long to get used to it. It's a decision that people have to make. But that sets the tone. There are schools that only address their students by Master or Mr. and Miss. That makes a difference, doesn't it? If the student is always Master Tomlinson, then he starts to feel like Master Tomlinson. These are decisions that schools make. This is another example of catechesis. What role does prayer have in work? That a school begins and ends its days with morning and evening prayer. Does all kinds of good things. Students sing a whole lot more than other schools. They learn. They hear much more scripture. They learn how to pray with the church. But the subtext of it is that your work is always framed by prayer. And when students get used to that, year in, year out, then it's kind of odd on the day you don't have morning or evening prayer. Why? Because in the catechumenate, this has become normal in the arrangement of time. So that's the school is catechesis. The faculty is the school, is another thesis that I'd like to put in front of you under grammar. That the faculty is the school. The students aren't the school. The students' parents aren't the school. It's one of the very helpful things when you don't have a parent run the school. Because what inevitably happens is the loudest voice rules the roost. And as parents, we're too close to our own students. And so it's never simply a parent-run school. But the faculty, when the faculty is seen as the school, they are the primary learning community. And they take students along with them. We're going to develop that a little bit farther on down in your notes, where with the words of Jesus, when he says that when the disciple is perfect, he'll be like his master. Perfect means complete. So when education is completed, at least this level of it, we expect that you as a student are going to be like us as a faculty, for better and for worse. We're going to do our best that it's for better. But if catechesis is taking place, as it ought to be, it'll be for the better, and the student is like his master. So the faculty needs to be the center of the school, then. They are the primary learning community. The student becoming like his teacher. Jesus told the disciples, "When you will be like your you become like your teacher when your education has been completed." Now, that's a tremendous weight on the faculty, but it also releases the joy of the faculty, of those living in Christ. We're quite aware of our own failings, but we're aware of grace and redemption, and that this is something God uses. And you think of it as parenting. A father might say, when he's so aware of his own failings, "Well, I don't want the shall be like me. Or we might say, do what I say, not what I do. We make these things up maybe to comfort ourselves a little bit. We all know that the fact is, they're going to do what we do. It's just the way it is. Children are going to have heroes. And I heard someone ask once, well, why shouldn't that be the father and the mother? If we believe in anything of grace and Christ, yes, we know we're sinners, we know we're very incomplete, but is that really so far out? Like, who else should they imitate? Who else should be their hero? If grace means anything, why shouldn't our children look up to us? Why shouldn't they want to be like their dad? Why shouldn't they want to be like their mom? Of course they do. That's their natural instinct. They will, unless you dissuade them not to. But there's a very similar role with faculty. And students want to be like their teachers. Okay, how does a school, as a school, catechize? We mentioned school day, the school's scope and sequence, its curriculum, its behavior, speech, and dress policies. These are things that contribute to its ethos. There are also three presuppositions that negate catechesis, or at least good catechesis in the parish school. And I think that I chose three that I come across frequently in the church and at times have toyed with myself because they're part of modernity. The first is that rote memorization is not from the heart. If we believe that, and I don't think there's anybody who hasn't believed that or has attempted to believe that on a regular basis, because everything in modernity tells us that rote memorization is not from the heart, and therefore it should be avoided. It gets in the way of good education. The second is that using the body in worship is idolatry. And the third is that only the family should shape the child. Baptism, at the very least, is a confession that the family is not God. God wants us to use our bodies, not only in liturgical worship of Him, or I should say not only in working in the world, but also in worship. And He's the God. Jesus prays the Psalms, bow down as ye draw near. Jesus prays the Psalms in the Spirit to the Father. And we don't read it. That obviously is not a violation of the Ten Commandments. It would be inspired scripture and at the heart of Israel's prayer book. And we don't see any corrections of that in the New Testament. So maybe we need to correct some other thinking that we have. But catechesis in a school is going to rely heavily on enjoying memorization and repetition. The same way that we do in other things in life. I think everybody enjoys breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's highly repetitive. And we usually stick with pattern. And we like having birthdays every year. We like having other people greet us every day. Well, that's some of the grammar, some of the stuff. Put a few dots on the wall for us. Let's try to connect a few of these dots. Before I move on, are there any questions?
So three ways that you were saying that, three ways that, well, I just want to make sure I have the way down right.
Three ways that negates catechesis? Is that
right? And the third is?
Well, the three were rote memorization, is not from the heart. Secondly, using the body in worship is idolatry. And thirdly, only the family should shape the child. Those are three presuppositions that really get in the way or undermine the whole parish catechesis. I'm understanding the school is part of the ministry of the parish, part of baptismal vows. Okay, some of the logic of this. Christine picked up a good book, and we just started reading parts of it on the way back, so we don't know it intimately. But the best love of the child and its thesis is that there's the two rights of humanity, being loved and being taught to love, as the first human right. Timothy Jackson's the editor. Good essays in there. And he makes the point that there's this myth that really up until the Enlightenment really sunk in. Everybody, especially the church, mainly ignored and abused and used the children. And, it's just a rough time growing up because you were likely to be unloved. and parents were just rough with their children. And makes the point that scholarship of the last 10, 15 years sees that primarily abuse and neglect in the medieval child rearing is becoming increasingly discredited. The book, I think, is mainly one of its best values is just in its resources listed. Great scholarship. The Best Love of the Child. Editor is Timothy Jackson. A tremendous bibliography and compilation of medieval sources. Right around, you don't have much written, of course, before paper becomes cheap, so most of the written resources aren't going to happen until the 1400s. But the medieval goals for the youth, says, were discipline, mastery, and honor. A child's value lay in what he could do, not necessarily in what he thought or he was. So the primary value is not in a contemplative life, but in loving God by doing God's work in the world. Fulfillment comes from bringing these as gifts within a relationship. And so the two rights, a child has a right to be loved by the parent. And a parent has a right to expect the child to obey. And these are considered the two prongs of the first human right. So that then naturally develops into other taboo language of modernity called the duties of love. The duties of love are mutually dependent, he says, but not mutually conditional. They are still owed one another regardless of the other's failings. And so children are called to rise above poor parenting rather than always to blame their parents. And parents are called to rise above ill-natured children. And instead of always blaming themselves for that, or children blaming their parents, everyone has a responsibility before God. This is working out the first table of the law. Now, Locke, Rousseau, and then Christianity starts absorbing some premises. And the first, of course, from Rousseau is that the child is naturally good. And rearing and schooling needs to bring that out. Secondly, children should express the true sentiments of the heart and not be forced to speak or behave falsely. And so by the time you hit the mid-1800s, you have these household manner books. And as Rousseau is adopted, and this is before real modern education, we're setting the precursors for 100 years before, that it is unnecessarily violent and it's immoral to force a child to speak respectfully. Rather, you need to make them feel respectful, and then they'll speak. This has become, I think, one of the foundations of modernity. I'm not just going to blame evangelicalism. You see it spiritually there, very much in the basic premise of speech. But I don't think it's fair just to blame evangelicalism. I think this is part of it became the base text of modernity. For example, if you teach your child to say the Lord's Prayer, you're obviously making a hypocrite. Because the child first needs to accept Jesus into their heart or whatever the language of the community is, then they can pray. I remember a man walking out of church when I was young. We sang old psalms when I grew up. But in the back of the psalter, there was the Lord's Prayer, which is music. So that was once given as congregational hymn. It was a man who led his seven children and wife out of church because you might be forcing a non-elect to say, Our Father. That's an extreme example. But you have this idea that first you change the inside, then you change the outside. And that's from Locke and Rousseau. First of all, the child is not a sinner. He's naturally good. But education should not involve that kind of force. You can't make someone speak respectfully. You first, they need to become a respectful person, and then they can speak respectfully. The third is that society replaces the primary responsibility of the parent and the self, or the child, through universal schooling. So whereas before, the child had an obligation before God to obey his parents and be respectful and honor them throughout life, and the parent had an obligation to correct the child, to care for the child, to nurture the child, and to love the child. This is now entirely removed. And Cook is a Christian feminist from the 1880s. Lady. And she's the first lady to run for president, by the way. I think it was 1880s. And she's the one who will first argue publicly that when a parent, when this isn't going well in the home, the state has an obligation and a right to take the children out of the home, because society, the state, has the primary responsibility. That's a major shift that grows out of Enlightenment theology, that places the primary responsibility on the state. It's no longer the child or the parent who has a primary responsibility in this. This is similar to marriage and its Enlightenment counterpart. Is marriage the place for self-fulfillment or the place of the ultimate gift of self to one another? I'm sure if you've ever had any Father Hauser's workshops, it always becomes theology of the body in some way, shape, or form. It's great theory. But one of the basic premises of that book is that in marriage, we have the gift of self to another. And that is marriage. And that is the that is where a man and woman reflect and are the image of God. Reformation thought tended, especially after the Enlightenment, tends to see man as the image of God primarily, and he's a rational being. The historic position of the church is that man is primarily the image of God, and that he's a sexual being, and that it's male and female. As male and female, giving one another, giving the self to one another as gift, that is the image of God, and there we have the picture, the image of the divine Trinity. But after the Enlightenment, just as we have this shift in child-rearing, so we have this shift in marriage, that marriage is a relationship, a contract in which we agree with one another, we'll stay together as long as happiness is given. And really that's concupiscence, isn't it? That the other person exists to please me. And there's a relationship between this parent-child relationship and in marriage, that both come out of this same idea. All along, children and parents have been taught by all the manuals. That's a great idea. It's warm in here. Both Catholic and Protestant, in the first 100 years after the Reformation, taught parents and children to view themselves as gifts from God for the other. And you have this very similar language that you'll find in Theology of the Body later on marriage, of this spousal relationship of being gifts to one another. That's classic language of child rearing from both Catholic and Protestant sources. That the parent is God's gift to the child, despite his failings, and the child is God's gift to the parent. John Wesley responds to Rousseau by saying, "A more consummate coxcomb never saw the sun." And his comments about Rousseau's Emile, "The most empty, silly, injudicious thing that ever a self-conceited infidel wrote." Enlightenment thinking made some positive contributions to the rights of children that resulted in a more balanced approach. And I think that needs to be granted. But I would say that it's a balance of what ought to, what had been taught, and a correction to the ability of those in power to abuse those who aren't, rather than caused by the Enlightenment.
Rousseau abandoned many bastards. Literally.
He knew of them too.
Yes, he knew of them, and he literally abandoned them, left them for the care of the church.
And he was asked to help with several of them. And refused, knowing that they died. Vocation. One of the most important things in these household manuals. Now, we must not forget one very important admonition which should be frequently inculcated to young students. That is, to pray often and fervently to God for His grace to know their vocation. Henry Dixon, English instructor in Boston in 1746. Now, a few things that I've tried to isolate in my own mind in talking to parents before enrolling, and saying, helping them determine whether a parish school is a good idea for them. You don't really want to find that out in October, if it's not the case. Or have endured it all the way through May. If it's really not going to work, if it's really not a good idea, let's find that out now. So I tried to put out some of these more difficult ideas when I would interview parents earlier on, because I've seen too often that parents almost always want the results of parish education. They very often do not want the methods. And they think that they can endure methods, or they haven't really, they've just kind of blazed through that, because I want my child to be like this, and I think I'm going to make my child like this. But then the method that we use, if I goes against so many of these enlightenment presuppositions. One of the things that I developed for them is that because the child is finite, education will be formative. We're not going to reach down into ourselves to find all that is good and true and beautiful. God is the standard of truth, goodness, and beauty. And because we're finite, education is going to be formative. It's not going to be an exercise in self-expression. And so the very first writing exercise after summer vacation might be, what did you do for vacation? But the very, it's not going to be, oh, what do you think about this, that, or the other? And you know, as a teacher, they don't know what to think about this, that, or the other. You're not cultivating stream of consciousness thinking as if they are the judge or the arbiter of what is good and true and beautiful. Rather, they'll imitate the masters and then become conformed to the masters. You fill the minds with the grammar of faith and all knowledge, and then start connecting that, and then they can begin writing opinions about things. Secondly, because the child is a sinner, education will be corrective. We are going to stop your child. Catch them. And by God's grace, they will be caught. But we assume that your child is going to sin. We assume that your child naturally loves himself more than God without God's constant grace. That's an assumption. It's not the exception. It's the assumption, because that's who we are. Now, it's not the whole story about us, but it is who we are. And it's why Scripture addresses children. Paul applies the fifth commandment. The fifth commandment is honor your father and your mother. That's a timeless, lifelong thing. Paul will apply it by saying, children, obey your parents. And we'll say this is the first commandment of promise. So we know he's thinking about that commandment. But the fifth commandment is not simply about children obeying their parents when they're young home. It's much greater than that. But Paul does apply it in that way. And then thirdly, because God is Holy Trinity, education will be communitarian. It's not about self-discovery. It's not about the self on his own little trip discovering things on his own. Education is communitarian because God is Holy Trinity. So the catechesis of the parish school, when I think of any school, has the ability, and I have a list for you here, and I'm sure this could go on to many productive things. I've just chosen a few. The first, beginning with grammar, I suppose, is that it can stock the mind. There are things that need to be learned. One of the curriculum publishing companies has a 4 or 5 year history, and they have all these cards. Good Shepherd has taken different ones from each of those 5 sets, so you have a manageable 30 that become the permanent canon of graduating from Good Shepherd. And those are the ones that are on the wall in the lunchroom. They're still up. And I doubt that you very often go down there and simply recite through all the cards. But you have recited your timeline many times in classrooms throughout. And then when you're there for early care or after care or some lunch or your art project, they're just part of the furniture. And you have their pegs that identify all the time. We have, I found 7 faces of 7 deadly sins once, the one from Mr. Vincent. I put them on the wall. And we never really talk about them a whole lot, but they're all there, they're labeled, they make an impression over the years. We stop the mind. You're not going to be very good at algebra if you don't know the times tables. And if you do get really good without learning the times tables, you can be very, very slow. And when kids haven't gone through a school system where the mind has been stocked with their addition facts, their subtraction facts, and their times tables, you see them, is it not allowed to use your fingers on the desk? I don't know. Or you'll see them with their hand on the desk and just pushing down without raising the fingers. It takes a long time. It's not hard to catch them. Sometimes we've had to have students sit with both hands under the desk so they can't see their fingers at least. And then we'll start going through them at a faster rate than it can possibly be done with fingers. They have to learn this. This is part of the grammar. You have to know these things. So, but the catechesis of not just Paris school, but any school, has the ability to stop the mind. It has the ability to develop the heart with habits. Morning and evening prayer is one. That when you transfer from class to class, that generally it's a good idea for it to be a rule that we're going to do that without talking. Then it really comes in handy when other people are in the parish and it has to be quiet. But it's a good discipline. It may be that other times, you know, the teacher's going to have them always recite their work between point A and B. But these are habits. It's not, oh, what are we going to do today? I'm free to walk as I wish and speak as I wish. These are all habits that school has the ability to form. A really important one is the ability to share the story. Education is entering into the one great story, sometimes called great conversation. Great books courses will use that language. Mortimer Adler will write a good bit about that. But we enter into the great conversation. What kinds of things have we wondered about in Western civilization for the last few thousand years? That's called the great conversation. What is true? What have we considered beautiful? But part of that is being able to reminisce. And we read also of just the way a mother might do this with a young child. What was one of the examples? Going to a fair or circus or this bike trip. And remember when we went on this bike trip and you were so tired? No. But where were you sitting? You know, you could just stop the conversation there, couldn't you, if the child says no. But where were you sitting? I was sitting on the back seat of the bike. But you weren't tired, were you? No, I wasn't. No, I wasn't tired. And you could stop the conversation there again. Next question. But didn't you walk across that bridge? Yeah, I walked across the bridge. Why did you walk across the bridge? I don't know. After we got across the bridge, did you get back on the bike again? Yeah, I got back on the bike again. Were you afraid? I don't know. But you see, a conversation could have ended at any one of those questions. But by reminiscing over a story and asking particular questions, you engage the child not only to remember the story, but to start saying things that they wouldn't ordinarily have said without the question. So that's what a teacher is doing. And then bringing a child from kindergarten on up to 12th grade into the great conversation. And a lot of this is through memory. We realize very quickly through the study of history, and then just in the daily Bible reading, and then praying the Psalms, singing the Psalms, that our story is a whole lot bigger than my story. I used to begin my Old Testament class by reminding the students and having them repeat quite often about Israel, that their story is our story. We belong to these people in some way, shape, or form. I'm connected to them. And we're going to learn about more of that during the year. But I'm going to take as a basic premise that I'm connected to these people. Somehow their story is my story. Because I'm part of the people of God. And God has one people. And I belong to them. So we reminisce. Education is about remembering. Oh yeah, what was Planet Sight when the days of Shadow Rain? But why then? Why could now all of a sudden we get one king to rule over the others? How did that work? How did they bring that about? How long did that last? Why didn't it last then? Too long after that. But this is all part of the great story. Education is entering into this story, and it's the reminiscing. You see how education, a model of education that views schooling as putting marbles in a pocket so that you can do well on your multiple choice tests, persuade people that you really are smart enough to get accepted into this college because you did really well on multiple choice tests. And now you can give me a scholarship, and I'll take the money. But education is not simply putting marbles in the pocket. Another picture that's given is a spider thread. We're creating a web that is able to catch things for the rest of your life and process them. Very different view of education. Well, if a school has this idea of the web and creating a mind that can observe, understand what somebody has been saying, imagine yourself in another place, process what has been written, formulate opinions and arguments, that is largely populated by the stories over which we reminisce in education. We enter into hope with people of times past. What did make them hope in their time? The stories of the Bible, of Western civilization, of nations, of states, of regions, of churches, and of families. And one grade level, pick on your chair again, fourth grade, you go through the Texas Project. You sit for 10, 15 minutes, 3-4 days a week. You're doing some work. By the end of the year, you have this really nice binder that you've made. All these great things. You know a lot about Texas because you've devoted some time for a few days throughout the whole year. You learn about your own church as a denomination, as a parish. You have a history. If it's an old church, you can look way back. When I had took my 9-year-old to Holland this summer, and stopped in London for the weekend before, and then saw as many churches as we could in Holland, and you have all the lists of the ministers, and most of them go back to between 1100 and 1300. That's where most churches go back to.
5 minutes.
Thanks. Obviously, her story is only 9 years old. That isn't true, is it? When you start teaching that, then she realizes, my story is a whole lot bigger than 9 years old. I'm part of that story. A parish school has the ability to guide our love. What is worthy to be loved? When we pray every day in chapel, St. Timothy's, most of it, open our eyes to see what is beautiful, our hearts to love what is true, and our minds to know what is true, and our hearts to love what is good. And then there's another one that teaches it where we ask, hate all that is evil in my sight. As parents sometimes cringe, you're praying so you can learn how to hate. Well, as long as it's as God does, then it's perfect, isn't it? But there are some things that deserve to be loved. And you as students are going to love all kinds of things that don't deserve to be loved. We're going to guide love. To whom can you give love? How do you love? What are the duties of love? Probably a comprehensive thing of what the school is able to give is a shape to the soul. What I wanted to get to is this conclusion that it's all about culture. And curriculum is important. You want to turn out good academic students, but it is all about culture. And that's a whole lot less tangible up front. I asked you about a school. What else has the power in peers, teachers, and habits to shape souls as extensively? Do you know of anything else in the world?
Media.
Pardon?
Media.
Media? Okay. It is a tremendous power, isn't it? That a child will look his parent in the face and say, no, my friends want to do this. Or the commercial says I should love that. The song says this. And that will trump the parent. That is power. I think there's a law in this. Whoever is most coherent wins. Whatever voices have the most, that are most coherent one to another, so that sound the most like we're speaking with one voice, if that's media, school, and peers, they're going to win. Now, what about bad Christian schools? I don't want you to think or imagine that I've said today that a school is a good school just because it's a Christian school. Or a school is a good Christian school just because it's a parish school. I don't believe that. I don't think you should have it. Well, let's move on the last few minutes, when we get here a little earlier, to rhetoric and conclusion. Church, family, and school. They don't need to be saying the same things. You don't need redundancy. But they do need to speak the same language to build a common culture. And the culture is so powerful that I wonder whether you can even make it with 2 out of 3 for the most part today. There is so little coherence to the voice of Christian life and practice that having only 2 out of 3, in fact, often when people have 3 out of 3, they still lose. There are no guarantees here. They're dangerous times. They're also exciting times. I think the church is having to return to its calling and what it's done for many, many centuries already. But each of these is needed. And whatever kind of school is used, whether it's homeschool, parish school, or somebody's in public school, I don't think it's impossible to make this happen. I think the responsibility of parents and prospective parents is to be thinking about how can we speak with one language? Because the language that has the most coherence is the one that's going to win the day. Each is needed. And I noted to you earlier that baptism confesses that the family is not enough. In ecclesiology, which places the family first, Reform Presbyterianism, or the individual first, Baptistic ecclesiology, sees the church as a collection of individuals or of families. In ecclesiology, which begins first with the bride of Christ, or with the church as the bride of Christ, or the body of Christ, sees Christ and the church as the new Adam and Eve, the parents of the new creation. Bishop Grove likes to remind us from time to time of Adam and his church before he was family. Not denigrating family, I'm just saying this is the proper order of things. The church is the bride of Christ, and our families and as individuals, we have a place within that. So we need to use the pieces that we have. There's a study I'm not going to read to you entirely, but it says, apparently parents are also unaware or unmoved by studies demonstrating that youth are strongly influenced by their parents' stance toward religion, with or without much discussion. For example, 3 in 4 U.S. teens consider their own religious beliefs to be somewhat or very similar to their parents. Only, I think it was 6%, consider their beliefs to be very different from their mother and 11 from their father. They're going to do what you do, not what you talk about. They're going to do what you do, and most of them talk about it. If it's apparent that we just go to church once in a while, or maybe even regularly, but it isn't an integrated Christian life, that lacks the coherence of many days. The coherence of school, of media, peers, is going to win the day. The take-home message is that parents nearly always shape the spiritual identities of their children one way or another. So, I'm telling you today, the faculty teach, but the parish school teaches how to work, to have friends, how to court and be married, to worship, to mature, to be a churchman, and to die. The church has been doing this for a very long time. As one attendee noted at school conference last week, he had an education conference, and the church wasn't mentioned once. And he got it right. He said, you can't do this without mom. What's he referring to?
Church.
Church. So, back to culture. We increasingly lack what was called a critical mass in our schools. And the critical mass of solid, stable families who are on board with the vision of school is getting smaller by the day. And that's not going to turn around for quite some time, I don't think. What are the school movements going to do when that mass is no longer critical? You need mass. Gravity is the attraction toward the center of that mass, isn't it? You need mass for gravitational attraction. Only the church can provide that critical mass that the independent, public or private schools have relied upon families and the general culture for in the past. So I wish that we had more parish schools, but it can be done very badly, and it has tremendous stresses and problems that need to be overcome also. So this is not an argument for everybody to try and start prayer school right away. It is something for us to think about or find a way to achieve the coherence of language that is needed to combat culture. Now I want to ask you at the end some questions. What does a school teach? I'll give you a few hints. A school is going to teach every single one of its graduates about what is really important in life. It's going to teach them who said it and whether it's still true today. What is good? Whom should I copy or emulate? What should I do with my body? And does it matter? What matters anyway? Why? What does it mean to be a good citizen? And we heard today, what was it, to be moral? Not to be a jerk?
Yeah, or...
That's effective catechesis. That is what people believe. If that's what people believe, somebody's catechized them very effectively. What is the point of education and how should it be used? The school will have taught as catechesis, what is success? What does success look like? If you're from Dallas, I've said it before, probably not quietly enough, but I think Dallas is an idolatrous, image-driven town. What does success look like in Dallas?
Big house.
A fancy car.
Big hair.
Big hair.
Big hair.
Somebody's caught that. Somebody's caught that, and you can't blame the public schools for that. Can you? A school, very effectively, a school is one of the most powerful catechetical engines in society. And it does teach. It teaches very effectively. It teaches so effectively that parents can rarely come through with anything that violates them. That's how powerful it is. I think we need to stop. Last questions, comments?
So it's got a piece of bottom. I was going to say that.
It's a good question.
Yes, because truth doesn't come from the inside out. Since the child is finite, education is stronger, and therefore,
because we're arguing to come.
But Chesterton has said all through education is fine.
Yes, I wasn't entirely persuaded by Steve. Number one, there's nothing wrong with us. Somebody requires violence. I think the argument against is I was going to bring an illustration from woodworking for you. You can do violence to a piece of wood and cut it the wrong way against its grain to do something it shouldn't. You can't make a choice out of anger. But by working with wood according to its nature, there is movement, there's shaping, there's cutting, but that's not violence. That's shaping something according to its natural purpose.
I'd argue it's
we're not as bad as we could be. We're fallen, we're sinners. But because we are the image of God, God gave us the love, the goodness, truth, and beauty. We're made for that. We're made to love one another. We're made to be loved. That's how God made us. Sinful human nature doesn't mean that somehow that was ditched and there's another being. This being is marred and broken. It's still that being. And redemption is a restoration of that image. Thank you.
Thank you.